Welcome to the Dublin City Libraries and Archives podcast. Our new season looks back at Dublin One City One Book 2018, where we celebrated the long gaze back and the female voice in Irish literature. This wonderful anthology of 30 short stories is edited by Sinead Gleeson. While the events planned for this year's Dublin One City One Book are postponed, we encourage you to enjoy this year's choice, Tatty by Christine Dwyer Hickey, available electronically on Libraries Ireland's BorrowBox app and in libraries and bookshops when they reopen, and of course to listen back on this podcast. In this episode, Letters of Distinction, Martina Devlin discusses the fascinating letters from the Irish RM and the Long Gaze Back authors, Somerville and Ross, to each other and to their literary agent in the early 1900s. Recorded at the National Library of Ireland on the 30th of April, 2018.
Edith Somerville and Violet Ross were born during the Victorian period into two ascendancy families, the Somervilles and the Martins, who were related to each other by blood. They were actually second cousins. Edith was born in 1858, and Violet, whom she always called Martin, because her nom de plume was Martin Ross. Violet was born 4 years later, 1862. And they didn't actually meet until they were in their 20s. Edith later called the meeting a hinge, the place where my life and hers turned over. So here they are. This was a publicity shot taken of the two of them when they were in their 30s for perhaps their best known novel, their third novel, The Real Charlotte. In fact, they jointly published five novels, three collections of short stories, and a number of travel books and lots of journalism. And then after Violet died, Edith continued using the dual signature for other novels, but she never wrote any more Irish RM stories without her writing partner. So in much of their work, they were charting a doomed society. It was the swan song of the ascendancy, and their caste's position was quite tenuous in Irish society, in Irish life at this time. George Moore calls it an entire race, a whole caste, saw themselves driven out of their soft, warm couches of idleness and forced into the struggle for life. And we see this happen not just in the novels and the short stories, but in the letters which Edith and Martin, as she called her, write to each other. Molly Keane memorably said that ghosts walk when you read their letters. To her, Edith and Martin were trying to escape the rigid limitations of class and era. Edith called these limitations of a lady's life, being born in a cage. And she rattled the bars, as did Martin, but they never quite broke free, partly because they were quite embedded within their families and within the social conventions. So, their first novel, I've brought along some of my personal library of novels. Anytime I find myself in a second-hand bookshop, or a charity shop, I root around, and I've managed to buy some old copies of the books. Their first novel's up there, actually. It came out in 1889, and it was called An Irish Cousin. And they referred to it all the time they were writing as the shocker, as in shilling shockers. And they had such a colourful way with words that even in their diaries they refer to writing as shockering. They were paid £25 down for it and £25 upon sale of 500 copies, which, you know, was not bad in 1889. Martin recorded it in her diary as the birthday of our lives. So from those beginnings, they wrote what's often described as the best Irish novel of the 19th century. That's The Real Charlotte. And the best humorous stories of Irish life. In the three Irish RM collections. It took them 10 years of writing together before they hit on the Irish RM formula, which was both a critical and commercial success. So those are just some of the books. They often have shamrocks on the covers. They were very much marketed as Irish books, but for an English market, a British market, really. Now, this is Violet Martin's ancestral home in, it's Ross House, and it's in Galway, near Uachtarard. They were a Norman family who had owned vast tracts of land, and then they lost a lot of their wealth during the famine period. They never really recovered after that. And this is Tresham in just outside Skibbereen in West Cork, in Castle Townsend. And this is where Edith Somerville grew up. And Somerville still live in Tresham, I'm happy to say, whereas unfortunately Ross House is no longer, it was sold in the 20s, and it's a hotel now and wedding venue. Both Edith and Martin were very attached to these family homes, which they could never inherit because they were women, and they poured a lot of their earnings from their writing into keeping the houses going, whereas often the men were a bit on the feckless side and tended to lose money. For example, Edith's oldest brother Cameron, who inherited, gambled on the stock market and left debts which she paid after his death. So their money was funneled into their homes, but also a lot of their time and energy. It was quite hard for them to find time to write. They wanted to earn money, though, and writing books and journalism was a way, a ladylike way to earn money at that time, where often, you know, they certainly couldn't have done other jobs. Their families, though, struggled initially to accept that they wanted to go off and write and that it could produce dividends. Because they were needed for hostess duties, they were needed to turn up for the afternoon teas and so forth, and they were needed to help run the household, and that became a particular problem from 1895 onwards, when Edith's mother died and she was the chatelaine of Tresham because her brother didn't have a wife. There's a letter to Martin from Edith from 1897, the exact date isn't on it. She says, "I don't look forward to going home. I suppose it would be too selfish for you and me to hike off somewhere to work and peace. It would be too selfish. Say no more, and let's shut our eyes to the splendid vision." So in later life, Edith's friend and composer Ethel Smith called Edith a stone in a tribal necklace. She felt that she gave in to her family too much. They only lived together, Martin and Edith, after Martin's mother died in 1906. And that was 20 years after they began their writing career. So often they were writing their books by letter and sending manuscripts backwards and forwards. They wrote their first tranche of Irish RM stories between 1898 and 1899. They were published first serialised in magazines and then as in book format, which is a sort of two for the price of one. It's quite lucrative because you get paid both times. And they used this format where possible again and again. I mentioned earlier that society was changing at that time in Ireland. The families often couldn't afford to live in the big houses and they were put to work. They would rent out their homes and they'd go and live in smaller houses, which they also owned, or they'd go and crash with relatives. Or in the case of one of the families, they stayed on their houseboat. So they rented them to people that they called the suburbans. They were quite dismissive of them while reliant on their money because they saw themselves as old gentry. So they liked the peasants and the country people, partly because they knew their place, whereas the suburbans were the ones coming in, buying properties from them, the middle class. There was a rising middle class in Ireland at this period, 1880s, 1890s, after the land war, and then, of course, post-independence. Martin always took pains to insist on their status as professional writers. She was furious, for example, about misprints in one of their novels, Dan Russell the Fox. She was very cross because the printers put in "the huntsman was loose on the moon" instead of "on the moor." And we know about these things from their letters to each other because they let off steam about them. They took their work seriously as professional writers. As early as the 6th of August 1893, Edith, in a letter to her sister Hildegard, complains about their cousin Herbert Green, who was also one of Edith's suitors. She said, "I must say he riles me most awfully in his persistently ignoring that I've any work to do." So at that time, she and Martin were working on The Real Charlotte, which they called The Welsh Aunt. They changed the name when it was published. She said, "Martin and I are worrying on with The Welsh Aunt through great disadvantages." Their letters were so lively that they were often read to the families at meal tables. They were read aloud, and there were warning signals were needed if there was a passage that wasn't for everyone to hear. And they had at least three different methods of alerting the recipient of the letter not to read the passage that was to follow. So they might, for example, use a phrase in Irish. They studied Irish. They found the pronunciation very hard, but they were quite good at the grammar. So they might use a phrase in Irish, or they might write a word backwards to slow down the reader. Or they would even just use the fairly obvious method of literally saying, "Do not read this aloud." The kernel of their stories that appear in the letters, you can see where the novels come from, because there are stories in the letters that are transcribed virtually word for word. The Real Charlotte is based on a true story that in Edith's family about a relative who did Edith out of her an inheritance, and then very gratifyingly died alone, surrounded by 14 cats. Which, as a cat lover, doesn't seem to me to be the worst thing in the world. So letters went backwards and forwards between them, helped by a very good postal service. Ross was related to quite a lot of famous people as one of the Martins of Galway, one of the 14 tribes of Galway. For example, she was related to Maria Edgeworth, and Maria Edgeworth was one of the first to use vernacular speech in a novel, and certainly Somerville and Ross did likewise. They used a lot of the terminology, very colourful language they heard from servants and the country people they met, and they wrote it all down. Martin was well known for just suddenly rushing out of a dinner party or an afternoon tea party to write something down. Edith Somerville had a different method. She was an artist, and in many ways she primarily saw herself as an artist, and she would always keep a little pocketbook in a pocket, and she'd take it out and she'd sketch. She'd actually draw a little picture to remind herself of something. They were on friendly terms with the Celtic literary revival, people like Yeats and Lady Gregory, who was another relative of Violet Martin's, but they were never part of the Celtic revival group. They objected to their romantic interpretation of the Irish peasantry. They didn't feel it was true to life. So they didn't care for the revival, and they steadfastly refused to write for the Abbey Theatre despite being invited to again and again. I have a copy of a letter here sent in 1901 to Edith from Martin, who was visiting Lady Gregory's house, Coo Park, and she describes W.B. Yeats in not the most flattering terms, as a cross between a Domini Samson and a starved Roman Catholic curate in seedy black clothes with a large black bow at the root of his long, naked throat. He is egregiously the poet, mutters ends of verse to himself with a wild eye, bows over your hand in dark silence, but poet he is, and very interesting indeed. He's not at all without a sense of humour, which surprised me, but he doesn't approve of humour for humour's sake. So their letters are crammed with family gossip, literary gossip, and humour, and they pick up on vulgarities of speech and chortle over it in letters, so they're quite snobbish themselves too. So one example of very colourful idiom they used in their letters is, "Ought I to write a grovel?" meaning, should I apologise? This is Castle Townsend, which is an extraordinary place in many ways, a few miles out of Skibbereen. So Drishan is at the top of the hill where Edith grew up, and then at the bottom of that hill lived the Townsends, cousins of hers. The Somervilles had married into the Townsends and the Coghills, married slightly above their own background, and that was their claim to gentry. That's Castle Townsend on the right, where their cousins lived. Edith's grandmother was a Townsend. And above it is St. Barahan's Church. They're buried there, and I'll show you that later. And this is the view back up Castle Townsend. The two trees there, people know it for the two trees in the middle of the street. It's an extraordinary place in many ways. It was quite bohemian at that time, it still is, but within strict enough social conventions too. Bohemian, but up to a point. I want to talk to you now about this man who was very important in their lives. His name, he was Mr. James Pinker, Mr. J.B. Pinker. And he was one of the first literary agents to set up in business in 1896. He was an enterprising journalist. He had worked for a well-known magazine called the Black and White magazine, and that magazine often serialised novels. So he encountered them that way when they submitted work to him. And he set up in offices just off the Strand. And there are many letters between the two. His other clients, there were a who's who of writers: Henry James, James Joyce, Joseph Conrad, D.H. Lawrence. Virginia Woolf called her dog Pinker after him, but she never signed up with him. Pinker paid over more than £6,500 over the course of their 24-year relationship with him. Well, 24 years for Edith, a bit shorter for Martin. So £6,500 between 1898 and 1922. That was a large sum of money. Edith earned £4,668.17/10 from him. And Violet, who died prematurely in 1915, earned £1,920.11/3. And it's interesting, the threepence and the halfpennies, because they were very careful about splitting their money and telling Mr. Pinker to take off the money for typing manuscripts and things. They had no problem discussing money at all, and they did it in great detail, and they referred to money as shekels, as David McWilliams does. They sometimes split the money 2/5 to one and 3/5 to the other, depending on who had done most work. And Edith illustrated all their books as well, so she would get extra money for that. But I mean, that was over and above the advance. For the Real Charlotte in 1894, they were paid £250 to share the publisher. Now, just to put that into context, that was good going when you think that for their first novel they were paid £25 as novice writers. Many of the letters, though, deal with trying to get the money paid to them. They say things like, "Prompt payment would be a great comfort to poor invalid and bankrupt authors." They're often asking for their money, or saying, "Aren't our royalties due soon?" Sometimes they didn't have the money for train fares. Sometimes they didn't have the money. They led quite a nomadic lifestyle. Edith often wanted to go to Paris to study art, and she used the earnings from writing and also her horse coping and other activities to pay for that. They wanted their money serialized, of course, because that was more lucrative as well. On the 9th of November 1911, Edith wrote to Mr. Pinker, "I shall be pleased to receive the publisher's cheque as soon as he can bear to part with it." Arnold Bennett was also one of Mr. Pinker's clients, and when Mr. Pinker died, he was widely acknowledged as the greatest agent of his time. In his will, he left £40,000. So to give you an idea of how other people were doing, Bennett was his most prolific and successful client, and he left £36,000 in his will. So Mr. Pinker had to tread a fine line, really, to work out his relationship with these two quite eccentric ladies. For example, Edith wrote to him, "You must always assume that if you write to one of us, you're writing to both of us." The very close communication between Edith and Martin, even though they weren't actually under one roof. They knew where the other one was moving around. There was a little bit of false modesty to begin with. They wrote, "We pretend we're literary ladies, but really we're frauds." In fact, they were very savvy businesswomen. They were constantly writing to him things like, "The RM has staying power sales-wise, and I hope the sales will be as good as the reviews." They kept on to him that the publishers weren't pushing their books as hard as they'd like. They wanted the sale price of copies to be cheaper, but the quality of paper to be better. And they were always, always complaining about the lack of advertising. They'd write things like, "Why should our books have to fight their own way when deadly volumes of sermons are trumpeted forth in every newspaper by our publisher?" And Edith to Pinker said, "Our books have been left to work their own passages." Now, this is a common complaint with writers, but if you do look at Longman's accounts, they did spend a fair bit of money on advertising for them. They just had very high standards and they weren't afraid to push for it. And this was not that common. Mr. Pinker was clearly quite charming, though. Perhaps you can tell from that image. And I think he worked out a good way to deal with them. In 1899, which was the year the first Irish RM stories were published as a book, he wrote to Edith, "I wish I only had Irish clients and they all lived in Cork, so I'd have an excuse to live there and help you with the hounds." Edith was the first female master of foxhounds in Ireland in 1903, and both Somerville and Ross were very keen on hunting, partly for the exercise. There were not many opportunities at that time for women to get fresh air and exercise unchaperoned. And when they were on horseback, they were the equal of any man, which wasn't always accepted in other circumstances. Pinker also wrote to them, again, another example of his charm, "I think your happiest work is in the semi-sporting vein, and there's no one who can touch you for that." So he wanted them, of course, to keep going with their semi-sporting vein, and he absolutely had to harry them, which is odd because the Irish RM was so lucrative for them, and they wanted to write the stories, but they could not always make the time to do it. On the 31st of January 1897, Edith's diary notes the first time the idea for the Irish RM stories was put to them. It wasn't their idea, incidentally, it was suggested to them. "Heard from Pinker. The Badminton is giving us £18 for the Grand Filly," that was a short story, "and want us to do a serial for them." So that was the genesis of the Irish RM stories, but they didn't start writing them for another 18 months. So June 1888, Edith's diary, "Heard from Pinker again. He said that Watson of the Bad Mag," that's the Badminton magazine, "is screaming for hunting stories." So they were slow to capitalise on interest in the RM stories, not least because Edith in particular could earn money in so many other ways. For example, if she trained a fairly good horse, as she often did, she could get £100 for that, and she could train 3 horses in a year. Her illustrations were bringing in money. She had been earning money since the age of 16 for doing illustrations for card manufacturers, and that was a very quick turnover of money compared with writing novels and the RM stories. However, Mr. Pinker scented his 10% commission, and he persuaded Edith to come to a meeting with their then publisher, Lawrence and Bullen. And in April 1897, she wrote about the idea being put to them. She said, "Then they all, including little Pinker, swore we'd got hold of a very good thing in this serial comic hunting business. To use literary slang," said Pinker, "this is your own stuff and nobody does anything like it." So Edith was very impressed by this and wrote to Martin that they had to buckle to, or some other Irish devil who can hunt and write will rise up and knock the wind out of our sails, and we can't afford to be jockeyed like that. She often used sporting terminology. Of course, she had lots of brothers as well and had quite a tomboy existence in her younger years. And she'd talk about women as squaws because her brothers did. Or if someone had to be really pushed to something, he must have been tomahawked. So really what happened then in 1888 is that they were on holiday in France. There was a cross letter from Pinker saying, "Where are the stories?" And it was a wet day and they couldn't go out picnicking and sketching. So they stayed in and talked into existence Flurry Knox, Major Yeats, Mrs. Cadogan and the other characters. And for the writers here, what that tells you is character preceded plot. The people in these stories came to life first before the situations. Just as an aside, Edith later tried to write a play of the Irish RM stories. It never came off, but when she was practicing it, she always wanted to do Mrs. Cadogan's voice. That was the part she wanted to play. She loved the humour. All the Somervilles apparently were very good at impersonations and doing different voices. So they knuckled to very quickly at that point, talked the characters into life in June. In July, on the 29th of July, they sent off the first Irish RM story to Mr. Pinker. That was Great Uncle McCarthy's Ghost. It appeared in the October issue of the Bad Mag, the Badminton magazine. And on the 13th of October, Mr. Pinker paid them. He obviously realised that this was how to keep the stories coming. And he paid them £18, 4 shillings and 6 pence, which they had to split. It's okay money, but bear in mind they're going to also get a payment for the book when it comes out, which Dickens did all the time too. So they were now bound to produce 12 stories at monthly intervals, which for two women who aren't always under the same roof and who do a lot of gadding as well, and Edith has her art, was quite an undertaking. And they struggled. They struggled with it. They particularly struggled because Martin fell off a horse. She was very, very short-sighted. She wore a pince-nez and she insisted on hunting still, and she really couldn't see the fences or the obstacles she was jumping, and used to follow the lead horse just and hope for the best. And the horse fell and rolled on her, and after that her health was never great, and she couldn't concentrate. She couldn't really manage the intense concentration that was necessary, and it did slow her down. She did get back up on a horse 10 months later, though. So it was really important to them. Let me see what other images we have here. Oh, now this is in the Pierce Library. This is the discontented little elephant. And this was Edith Alone. They sometimes did projects on their own. Martin wrote serious political journalism, and Edith was interested in doing a children's book, and she did. It's The Discontented Little Elephant, and there is a copy of it in Pierce Library. It's I've got some copies of the images which Pierce has kindly lent us, because I wanted you to see her illustrations. They're vivid. They're vivid. I think she was a very good illustrator. But as a children's writer, there's a problem with it, and I'll explain it to you as we go along. I'll just run through some of these quite quickly. This is about a little elephant who wants a longer trunk. He runs away from home and he goes into the jungle in a huff. This is the first page of it, and she did it in verse format. And though their looks were most absurd, they uttered no complaining word. That's the elephants. Now, he meets a tiger, which perhaps warning bells might go off. The tiger tells him that if he puts his trunk into his jaws, he'll get a longer trunk. Wow. This is what the Victorians, and remember, these were Victorian ladies, called a morality tale. So it's really quite cruel. Look, there's the monkeys throwing things at him. And there's old Stripes, the tiger, very pleased with himself. And look, blood is dripping. Edith really thought this was a children's book. That's the last page. The tiger says, "When children disobey, I hope they'll always come my way." So, very clear message. Now, you may not be surprised when I tell you the book was not a commercial success. And Longmans, her publishers, refused the follow-up book called The Crocodile King. And if you think that's bloodthirsty... But the illustrations are lovely. I've looked at the unpublished illustrations from The Crocodile King, and her illustrations are just so eye-catching. But there are a lot of little eaten crocodile babies in it, and human babies, and so on and so forth. Yeah. There's a very strong female character in it who takes on a crocodile, wrestles him. So... The to-ing and fro-ing with Mr. Pinker on this story was interesting. She needed to earn money for the foxhounds, and she kept having ideas and writing to Mr. Pinker about them, and Violet didn't always like her ideas, and particularly where, as Violet called it, doggerel was involved. And Violet didn't want to be involved, or Martin, I should say, didn't want to be involved in this. But Edith believed in the stories, but also felt that they would be a revenue generator for her. She was an artist, and this is a Harry Clark. It's a window in St. Barahan's, that lovely little church on the hill, Church of Ireland Church, that I showed you earlier. And this is a Harry Clark window that Edith had put in. And her diaries talk about going to look at his work in Dublin, and she's very admiring of it. You know, she believed in helping other artists. In many ways, art was her first love, as Martin knew and complained about. And then there was the love of horses and the love of foxhounds as well. So that's a closer image of St. Barahan's. And this is Edith and Martin are buried side by side in the churchyard there. Again, the artistic sensibility. This is Martin's grave, the great slab, you know, the lovely big slab. Edith is beside her. Martin died in 1915, although she'd had this fall from the horse in 1898. She had dreadful headaches after that, and well, she continued to work, but she was never in the whole of her health, really. Edith also had health problems because of her hunting and riding. She rode side saddle all her life. She totally disapproved of riding astride, but she suffered with gout and varicose veins as a result of, you know, the way you sit when you're riding side saddle. One leg is just propped up and doesn't get any exercise. And that was the leg that she was lame in subsequently. Little factoid, she rode on a very long stirrup or leather, as did Countess Markievicz, and they were both excellent horsewomen. And a long stirrup meant that your seat was, you could fall off, it was more dangerous, but it gave you more control. You could shift your weight on the horse if there was an obstacle ahead. It made you more nimble in the saddle. So people who did that really just cared more about the riding than the danger. So just coming to the end now, I should have told you, I think, that court proceedings were very useful source of stories for them. You see that in their own stories. And interestingly, Sergeant Sullivan, who was the lawyer who defended Sir Roger Casement in his treason trial, he started out in the Munster Circuit. And in his memoir, he talks about seeing Somerville and Ross scribbling away in court. And one of them was kind of untidy and had an engaging manner, a pleasant manner, and that was Somerville. And the other one was thin and remote and wore a pince-nez, and that was Ross. So from about 1888 on, they started keeping verbatim court reports just for the great stories in them. And they used them over and over again in their novels and their stories, sometimes retaining the information for 10 years and more before it made it into print, but they just knew that there was great potential for stories there. One other thing about them, they were suffragists, not suffragettes. So suffragettes used militant methods, had no problem lifting a stone and breaking the windows of government buildings because they felt that government was letting them down. Somerville and Ross were suffragists. They went to a very famous meeting of a very famous suffrage meeting in Hyde Park in the late 1800s. Heard Christabel Pankhurst speak, became all fired up, and felt that the vote was very important. Martin actually wrote to Edith saying that she felt it was outrageous that the men that her mother employed had the vote, but she didn't. So I'm not quite clear myself, and I'll have to read a bit more to see whether they wanted all women to have the vote or only ladies. Certainly they were active, though, in a Munster suffrage group, and Edith was the president and Martin was the vice president. So I suppose really what they were doing was always pushing for some level of self-determination. But in many ways they also went along with what the men of their family wanted. And perhaps the best example of that is Edith running Drashan for her brother rather than saying, you know what, it's your house, I'll never really be the mistress here. And I've got better things to be doing with my time. So does anyone have any questions? Liz.
Thank you so much, Martina. That's a wonderful presentation. I was just curious about, you were talking about their idea of self-determination. Did they have any view on home rule?
Yes. Yes, really good question. And I'm glad you raised it. In their letters, they don't talk about politics, because they had very different views on politics. So Martin belonged to a patrician unionist family who had no truck with home rule whatsoever. And neither of them had much time for Parnell, but Martin actually went north and wrote about the signing of the Ulster Covenant for the Spectator in glowing terms. So such glowing terms that Rudyard Kipling, who was also very pro-empire, read it aloud in his club. So She didn't believe in Home Rule at all and felt that the people were led astray by rabble-rousers. But now I should say that the Martins also, although popular enough with their tenants, for example, after land was sold to them, always still referred to them as our tenants, never really accepted that the relationship had changed. And Martin's brother, Robert, who inherited the estate, he was boycotted. So a lot of issues there. Now, Somerville evolved her view, and she did become a home ruler, as did some of her brothers. And in fact, on the night of 7th, 8th of May 1916, she wrote to the London Times. She used a nom de plume, she just signed it, an Irish woman. But she wrote saying, you know, enough with the executions. At that stage, I think the first three of the leaders of the Rising had been shot, and she was horrified. And she quoted an apocryphal mother from 1798 saying, "Spare them, O Lord." And yet she believed that there should be a devolved government for Ireland. And of course they stayed then after independence, whereas many families left. And she said that, they'd eaten Irish bread and rubbed shoulders with Irish people for 300 years, and they would try and see could they make their way here. It was more in hope than certainty, really. There was a lot of uncertainty at that time as to whether there would be a place for the remnants of this caste in Ireland. But certainly the Somervilles wanted to stay. Yeah, hi.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed that.
Thank you.
May I ask you, have you come across in their correspondence references to the occult?
Yes.
In it? And how? Because I read something about her brother Boyle and herself involved in sales in locations nearby, megalithic sites. Can you view them as Orthodox Christians? How are they in relation to that in that kind of late Victorian kind of period?
Yeah, so Martin wasn't interested in clairvoyance or seances or things like that. She found that it wasn't compatible with her Christianity. But the Somervilles had a great interest in the subject, and psychical research and in table turning and Ouija boards, table tapping, and they believed in it, and they found it compatible with their Christianity, and they were churchgoers. Edith played the organ in St. Barahan's every Sunday that she was there. They just made space for it in their belief system. And Edith had great comfort from it after Martin died. She believed that she was still writing her novels with Martin's help. She had a seance at 7 p.m. every evening, and did automatic writing, as Yeats did, and other people at that time. And she tried to materialise Martin, but didn't succeed. But she really believed they were in touch. And during the War of Independence and the Civil War, she believed that a ring of their ancestors were protecting Drishan. I think a gunboat down in the bay might have also been useful. There was a British gunboat there too. But she believed, you know. So does that answer your question? I can't really say how she managed to square the circle. It is odd. I suppose what I would say perhaps is that at that time there was a great openness to things like dreams and interpretation of them, and whether you could communicate through telepathy. And people were trying to find a way through this. And some of it was, some of it, there was something in some of it.
It wasn't therapy or anything.
It wasn't therapy, no.
It was a product of their life, but also a way of informing their world. Is that what you mean?
Well, that, but I mean, as well, there is, there have been studies done which would suggest that for women it was quite empowering, because, for example, a spiritualist, and the spiritualist was often female, had permission to say things which perhaps she couldn't in a strictly stratified society. So, I mean, I would see a parallel with that, say, with, for example, I wrote a novel called The House Where It Happened about a witchcraft trial. And it struck me from all the witchcraft trials I read, people who said they were possessed, they could act out and behave in very overt ways that they couldn't in that society. You know, they could say things and behave in ways that they perhaps couldn't in quite a structured society. It was quite liberating. Leah?
Do you have a preference for one of them over the other?
Well, I think that Martin was the better writer. So from the kind of writer's perspective, I would prefer Martin. I think that her, you know, she had a very, there was political nous there. You can see in, for example, a letter to her sister I read recently. They just understand political situations. Edith was more lighthearted. She was probably more fun in many ways, and she had lots of strings to her bow with the art in particular. And her humour, Edith's humour, was quite a gallows humour. So do I prefer either of them? I think they're both very interesting. I think that's...
Do you have affection for them?
Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. It's hard when... The problem is we're reading letters that are personal letters that were never made for public consumption. So it's not 100% fair in that sense. We all of us say things now in our text messages and our emails that if we knew in 100 years' time someone would be poring over them, we'd be a bit more careful, wouldn't we? But there is a snobbery, which I do struggle with a bit. They were very class conscious, and it's particularly odd in Edith Somerville's case, because she was not from as high a social class as she claimed, as the Somervilles claimed. They were descended from Scottish skinners, and they looked into their family tree and didn't like what they found and rewrote it. They deliberately rewrote it. They made their money from Edith's great-grandfather, who was called Tom the Merchant, and he built Trishan, and then they struggled really to have the money to keep it. And then they intermarried quite well. But they were great fun. They partied and they enjoyed themselves. But then in Edith's generation, the men had to, there wasn't the money for the men to have this idle life that George Moore referenced. And they went off to different parts of the empire, usually in the army and navy. But they always had this great affection for Trishan. I think that comes through. And what I've noticed with reading all around this period is that for some of the families, they were able to give their affection to the house. And they were able to give their affection to the landscape. And you can see that in what they write. But they struggled a bit to give their affection to the people. They did see, some of them saw themselves as different. Not so much the Somervilles, I would say. Not so much. That I think that they enjoyed people in all shapes and sizes. But you will get awful examples of snobbery in the letters. And I did, like, there was one I found where it wasn't safe to employ Catholics indoors. You could employ them on the land, but not indoors. And I think that was to do with the idea that you could be murdered in your beds by the natives. Yes?
But was Edith alive when her brother was murdered?
Yes. Yes, that was a very sad... Yes, it must have. And it was brave of her, really, to stay on there as an old lady. They were well-liked in the area always, and are still well-liked. Whereas I think the Martins, not so much, you know.
Because I gather Boyle, who was Boyle.
Boyle, yeah.
He was pretty armed. It was only because I think he wrote references for local guys to join the Navy, which they did anyway, you know.
Yes.
Cork was full of people who went off to sea, like to the Navy. And he had written a few letters, and I don't know who did it, but it seemed pretty cowardly.
And he was an old man at the time.
He was an old man. It was 1930.
Yes. So it was post-independence. Young men, there was awful unemployment in Ireland at that time, and local boys used to come to Boyle Somerville, who had moved back after a lifetime in the Navy. You know, he'd moved back as an old man. He'd lived in married quarters all over, and young men would come and get a reference from him to join the British Navy, and the local branch of the IRA apparently didn't approve of this, and he was murdered. And it must have been very hard for the Somervilles. Yeah.
Edith wrote a book on her ancestor, who's a member of the 18th century Parliament.
Bush, Charles Kendall Bush, yes. He was the Lord Chief Justice. And this was... It's partly a work of fiction, although it's presented as a biography. When she didn't know the answer to something, she had a séance and asked Charles Kendall Bush the answer, and she put that into the book as though it were fact. So he's the common ancestor between her and Violet Martin.
Yeah.
She got an honorary degree from Trinity, and that was the first time she met W.B. Yeats, I believe, and she was quite surprised that he looked like a comfortable country gentleman, as she described him, because from all Martin's descriptions of him, he was this very, very skinny, intense young poet. And it was great that she got her honorary degree, and oddly enough, I think it's the only D-lit that Trinity has ever given to someone who's dead and someone who's alive. Trinity doesn't like, I mean, you receive them as a living person, but Edith refused to accept it unless it was to both Somerville and Ross. There was another question. Yes.
Did the Drishan become a Catholic boarding school in more recent times?
No, it's lived in by another Tom Somerville. Tom Somerville is a family name. There are lots of Toms. Tom the merchant being the source of their wealth. And the family live there. Not with as much land as there would have been there once upon a time. But they're very proud of Edith. They have a little museum there. If anyone's in Castle Townsend, I'd urge you to go and see it. Edith claimed in later life that they wrote all their books in Drishan, but a lot of what Edith claimed in later life has to be taken with a pinch of salt, and we know that from reading the diaries, which are contemporaneous and are much, much more to be believed. So they did write the last few chapters of the Real Charlotte in a corner of the orchard field in Drishan, which was a very out of the way place where they would have a bit of peace, and they did some work there, or they did work in various houses in the village. I mean, these people were the original hotbedders. If there was an influx of guests, people would just move out to a relative's house in the village. It's a very unusual place. There are about somebody said. The high gentry does be hopping here, and other places are very low on gentry, meaning that there were about four families in this little area. It's very unusual because, I mean, someone like Elizabeth Bowen in another part of Cork who wrote a wonderful biography of her family, Bowen's Court, talked about the big houses being like ships at sea, quite isolated. But in Castle Townsend, there were four different families. There were the Townsends. They came over with Cromwell. There were the Somervilles, who came later and bought in. There were the Coghills, and there were the Chevasses, and they were all interrelated. And then, of course, there was a blood relationship through Charles Kendall Bush, the first this Lord Chief Justice. There was a relationship through him with the Somervilles.
When you spoke about writing chapters in the corner of the orchard, what does the manuscript show us? Did one dictate, or did they take turns and you write now? And
yeah, there are lots of scribblings out, and even though they clean copied things, you know, they'd write a manuscript, scribble all over it, only they could read it, and at the end they do a clean copy. And then in subsequent years they used a typist. And they say themselves it was really just a case of arguing back and forth, and whoever had the pen wrote it down. And one manuscript has something about a kiss, and someone, I think Edith, it looks like her writing, has written puke on it. Because her language was quite schoolboy, putrid. She talks about things being putrid or pukey. So really, I mean, who did what? I mean, Edith has the best description of who did what. She said they had three writing styles. So a style when one wrote, a style when another wrote, and the third when they wrote together. And she compared it, the artist in her compared it to blue and yellow equals green. But certainly you could say that the romantic scenes were written by Edith, because she had much more experience of romance than Martin. She had suitors. But for a woman at that time, marriage wasn't necessarily the best option if you had alternatives. I mean, there was more social status by getting married, and an unmarried daughter was someone on her family's hands. But at the same time, if you could earn money, which they did, they had socioeconomic independence from their writing, and then the need to marry if they didn't want to wasn't so pressing, you know. So they chose not to, as other women in the family did too. One of the Coghill cousins became one of the first women doctors. Another relative was a well-known artist, Rose Barton. Ethel Penrose, another cousin, a Coghill cousin, wrote children's books, and Edith illustrated them for her. So they were quite go-getting women. Were there any more questions?
Was it true that a man called
Hewitt Poole, yes, that. So Hewitt Poole was Edith's first love when she was 19, and he had an unofficial engagement to Mia Jellett, Mainie Jellett's sister, and he came to Castle Townsend, and he was exactly Edith's type, which we know from the romantic heroes in the novels. Fair-haired and athletic, good on horseback, often with a little moustache, quite a military type. And they seem to have fallen in love. And her father, the colonel, made it very clear that his prospects weren't good enough for Edith, and it came to nothing, unfortunately. And then she also seems to have had a romance with Barry Yelverton, who was quite infamous, the Yelvertons. There was an infamous court case involving his father. His father had married, he was a lord, Lord Avonmore. He'd married a Catholic woman, and then claimed that it wasn't a valid marriage because she was Catholic. And he just went through the, he said he just went, there was a court case, he said he just went through the motions so that she would think they were married, but of course he knew they weren't. And an Irish court found that the marriage was legal, but a British court found not. So Barry Yelverton was his son by the second marriage, and Barry Yelverton's father, his good name was in tatters over it. So there was they came to Ireland subsequently, hoping people would have forgotten about it, but people didn't forget. Yeah. After the failed love affair, if you like, I think her family seemed to have felt a bit sorry for her and realised perhaps she had been ill-treated, and she was allowed to go to London to study art, which she'd been wanting to do anyway. You see, she was educated at home by governesses, apart from one term at Alexandra College in Dublin, and Violet Martin, by comparison, had gone to Alexandra College through her from the age of about 10 or 11. So, you know, she had been educated at school. So Edith, I went to London, then to Dusseldorf, and then finally to Paris and studied art. And when she had a bit of money, she'd take classes, and she was quite serious about it. And there are some lovely examples of her art, including, I'm happy to say, a wonderful painting in Dreshan of one of the local women. She often used them as models. And she used Martin as a model sometimes too. Sometimes for her comic sketches for newspapers, she'd... I know Martin is the model for a violin player in one of the comic sketches she sent in, and family members. So if there's one thought really to take away with us from today, it's that they saw stories all around them. And they, I guess, by engaging at all levels of society with people and talking to them, and apparently they were very good at talking to people across the social register at that time, it paid back dividends because they heard the most colourful language, and they had an ear for it, wrote it down, reproduced it. So we have a good idea of how people spoke then. Why I say it paid dividends is because it fed into their books. And one line that I've always loved, which Edith wrote to Martin, she said that she went into the kitchen and there was a beggar woman sitting there in the kitchen being given tea and something to eat. And the beggar woman said... Edith came in complaining about something, and the beggar woman said, "Well, I'm very sorry for you, my decent lady, but the will of God it is." And she immediately wrote that down and used it. And when you read their books, they're peppered with these phrases, and you can see behind them there was a living human being.
Thank you for listening to the Dublin City Libraries and Archive podcast. To hear more, please subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud. You can also visit our website, dublincitylibraries.ie, where you can sign up to our newsletter, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our theme tune is Dream of the Forest by Articom. If you're interested in podcasts, why not check out the Dublin Festival of History podcast, which features recordings from the free annual event, and the new City of Books podcast with Martina Devlin, the podcast for people who believe stories matter and that you can never have too many books.